My name is Keith Goodman, registration number 37769. May it please the court, counsel. When the plaintiff, Mr. Scott Munt, sued the NSF, both parties demanded a jury trial. That jury trial was held in October of 2012. After 5 days of evidence and argument, and after 5 hours of deliberation, the jurors returned a unanimous verdict. The trial court erred in setting that verdict aside by finding instructional error where there was none and which had not been properly objected to, and by relying on a new trial standard that has not been applicable in Colorado for 30 years. The NSF respectfully requests this court overturn the district court's new trial order and reinstate the jury's October of 2012 verdict. There were two grounds cited.
Counsel, can I ask you a question? You're familiar with the McLaughlin case?
Yes.
And in your brief, you indicated like a judge cannot rely on the idea that he or she is dissatisfied with the jury's verdict. That's an outmoded standard.
Correct.
In McLaughlin, the division of this court said that the district court has considerable discretion ruling on a motion for new trial, and the court should not grant a motion for new trial where the error did not prejudice or harm the parties seeking a new trial, or where the trial resulted in substantial injustice. Does it imply that if it believes that the trial did not result in substantial justice, it has the prerogative to grant a new trial?
I agree that a trial court has discretion to grant a new trial, presuming that it properly finds one of the enumerated grounds in Rule 59D.
Is your answer no, then?
My answer is, if there is in fact error found, then yes, a trial court has the discretion to grant a new trial if it finds the first trial did not result in substantial justice. Let me turn first then to the first of the two grounds relied upon by the district court, that being the lack of a clarifying instruction as between a thin skull and a pre-existing condition instruction resulted in prejudice justifying a new trial. This ruling was an error at the outset because the objection to the instruction was not made. In fact, under these circumstances, it was invited.
Let me ask you a question. McLaughlin says a clarifying instruction ought to be given when the two instruct. You don't disagree with it. I guess you do disagree with that proposition law, but that is the law that binds us at the present time if we follow that division, correct?
That is correct, if you follow that division.
Right. Don't think that case was wrong decided and we should follow the 10th Circuit case, the name of which escapes me right now. But assuming that we follow McLaughlin, that instruction ought to have been given, correct, in this case?
I would suggest a proper reading of McLaughlin is this. Consistent with the notes on use to Colorado civil jury instructions, either a clarification or a modification needs to be given to harmonize the potential overlap between instruction 6:7 and instruction.
And you were the lawyer at the trial, if I read the transcript, right?
That's correct.
And at the jury instruction conference, didn't you yourself try to get Judge Stern to give a clarifying instruction and kind of brush it off because we were in a big rush?
Yes. So there were two steps. The first being we proposed a deletion of, I think it was 5 words.
Hardly
a shell. The plaintiff agreed to that modification. Right. Then BNSF felt like to further protect its interests, additional clarification was needed.
And that was based on what McLaughlin had said 3 months earlier. It was cited to the judge, wasn't it?
Certainly. The need for a clarifying instruction from both the notes on use and McLaughlin was brought to the court's attention. But again, that clarifying instruction, which was tendered by BNSF and objected to by Mr. Munt, we believe is necessary to protect our interests.
So the reason you're now telling us we should not review that decision by the trial court is because at that very moment, plaintiff's counsel did not also say, Judge, I object to your failure to give the instruction that the railroad is asking for.
That's correct. By agreeing to the modification that we proposed and then objecting to our further clarification, If Mr. Munt believed additional clarification was needed to preserve or protect his interests, it was at that point in time that he needed to speak up.
You say he objected to the clarification instruction?
That's right. In the record, when I'm tendering the proposed clarifying instruction, I note for the court that Mr. Munt has objected to the additional clarification.
On the eggshell part?
That's right.
But not on the what we call the clarification instruction that, let's say, balances or discusses the interplay of the two instructions. There was no objection to that.
To be clear, what I stated to the court was consistent with the conversation I had with Mr. Munt's counsel was, this is an additional clarifying instruction I'm tendering, and Mr. Munt's counsel objects to this clarifying instruction. And Mr. Munt did not, Mr. Munt's counsel did not disagree or offer further clarification on that point.
And the clarifying instruction that you were offering was the one that said, take out some of the words from the eggshell? No, it's in addition to that, right?
That's right.
And the clarifying instruction would explain how the two instructions work together.
Something
along the lines of what McLaughlin suggested should be given.
Well, I disagree that McLaughlin suggested any sort of model language.
I definitely did not.
Okay. But yes, I mean, certainly additional clarification to clarify that BNSF felt like it needed to be stated that despite the language in the 6:7 instruction, a jury may still reduce the amount of a plaintiff's damages for a pre-existing condition instruction.
And the only reason Judge Stern didn't give it is best I can tell from the records, he just was running out of time and didn't want to retype the instructions.
Certainly that is what Judge Stern indicated during the jury instruction conference before closings began. I would add, though, that Judge Stern did offer the parties the chance to come back and clarify whatever record they wanted to make about either end of trial motions or the jury instruction record.
On October 24th, you guys came back.
That's right.
And plaintiff didn't say a word in that hearing about the lack of a clarified instruction.
Correct.
Then a few days later, whenever it was, filed a new trial motion.
In the motion for new trial, the first time Mr. Munt raised the contention that he was prejudiced by the lack of a clarification.
And Judge Stern recognized, I would say, that he made a mistake or he made an error in rushing to the jury instructions, and he should have given the clarified instruction. And that's why that's one of the reasons why he granted a new trial.
Well, to be clear, though, Judge Stern was ruling on one of the contentions made by Mr. Munt in his post-trial motion for a new trial. Namely, Mr. Munt specifically asked that Judge Stern grant him the trial for, among other reasons, the lack of a clarifying instruction.
And the reason you say we should not review that is because they didn't make an objection to the lack of a clarifying instruction when you were trying to tender one to the court.
They neither objected to the lack of a clarifying instruction or tendered one that they feel like would have protected their interests.
And if we can correct this because substantial justice was not done, you don't think we should affirm that part of this order that says give them a new trial because we rushed into the jury instructions and didn't include an instruction that should have been given?
While there were some time constraints put on our jury instruction conference, even up through October 24th, Mr. Munt never proposed what that instruction would look like or, importantly, under these circumstances, how any confusion in the jury instructions would have prejudiced him as opposed to BNSF. Because recall the default or the catch-all language at the end of instruction number 28 read, if you're unable to separate what came before versus what came after, the tie in that sense would go to the plaintiff, and he's to be awarded the full measure of his damage.
Was a clarified instruction, I just have to ask this, in the second trial, was a clarified instruction given? Both instructions were given. Was a clarified instruction devised?
You know, certainly a clarifying instruction was tendered. subject to being corrected by the record.
Okay.
My memory is the same modification of 6:7 was tendered and given to the jury.
Okay. Counsel, was there an objection to instruction number 18 by Mr. Munt?
There was.
By any parts of instruction number 18 by Mr. Munt?
No. Mr. Munt, at the close of evidence, objected to contributory negligence being given to the jury for their consideration. And again, on October 24th of 2012, Mr. Munt renewed his objection to contributory negligence being given to the jury.
Would that objection have subsumed any of the asserted grounds for claiming contributory negligence in the instruction?
Not for the purposes that are being argued on appeal. And what I mean by that is the contention on appeal is now Mr. Munt was prejudiced by the inclusion of three factual theories of negligence. There's no fight about the fourth. Under those circumstances, the case law suggests that it is incumbent upon the party raising the issue to either lodge specific objections or tender a special verdict form so that if a party feels like there's at least a potential for prejudice by the four factual theories being given, the jury will render a verdict and presumably assign percentages for each of those factual theories. That not having been done, they cannot claim prejudice under the circumstances where it's not disputed now that the defense of contributory negligence was properly before the jury.
Counsel, do you agree that assumption of risk is no longer a defense under FELA?
Yes, absolutely.
Under cases such as Wilson, Burkham, Taylor, which talk about the employer's non-delegable duty to give safe equipment, to not put the employee in a position where he has to do work with, let's say, unsafe equipment, why don't those cases apply here? Why aren't those three options, I'll call them, or factors of the contribution to negligence really tantamount to assumption of risk?
Sure. So the distinction that's borne out in cases like Jenkins versus Union Pacific out of the Ninth Circuit, and here, Cruz versus Union Pacific out of Colorado's Court of Appeals, is this. If a general directive has been given to the employees, then it's incumbent upon the employees to use good, reasonable judgment in carrying out that task. It's contrasted with the circumstance where a specific instruction has been given to the employee, and the only theory of contributory negligence is that employee should have either refused to do the job or recognized that the task was so inherently unsafe that it could not have been reasonably performed. But the case law is clear that when there is a choice given to the employees, it's incumbent upon them, and it's their obligation to use reasonable judgment.
He has an obligation to refuse to do the job when he's asked to do a job?
No, absolutely not. And let me make sure I'm clear on this point.
Right.
We did not contend, either at trial, and we're certainly not contending on appeal, that Mr. Munt was negligent for having agreed to remove snow. The contention was he was negligent for choosing the equipment that he did for the job that he set out.
Did he have a choice? The other two snowplows were taken.
There was an additional forklift that was available without a windshield that he could have used. There was an additional piece of equipment, a blade, that could have been attached on the end of the forklift that would have been proper.
Was this a snowstorm?
Yes.
And without a windshield? Can people see without windshields?
Mr. White testified at trial that he was performing the same or similar job that Mr. Munt was with a forklift without a windshield. And again, the additional point that I'd like to reserve a minute and a half for rebuttal, if I may. The additional point concerning assumption of the risk that I'd like to raise is what the case law also suggests is if the trial court is concerned about the potential for overlap or confusion between assumption of the risk and contributory negligence, the court is supposed to, or can at least, instruct on a negative instruction that explains to the jury, this is what assumption of the risk is, and you cannot find contributory negligence because, as relevant here, an employee acceded to the request of a supervisor.
And no such instruction was given.
That instruction was given. It was instruction number 19 that was tendered by Mr. Munt and given to the jury by the trial court. With that, I'd like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. Will the bailiff please restore counsel's time for 2 minutes on rebuttal? We took up a fair amount of your time with questions. We'll give you 2 minutes rebuttal, and if you're going to need extra time, I'll give you a little extra time as well, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Hold on 1 second. We're going to have to figure out how to reinstate him to 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. not wing it with a watch. To the podium, counsel. I don't need to leave you hanging there. Just hold on one second.
Hello. All right.
Okay.
May it please the court, my name is Newton McCoy. I'm a member of the Missouri Bar. My Missouri Bar enrollment number is 26182, and I appreciate the courtesy of the court and allowing me the opportunity to appear in this case, Pro Hac VJ, today.
You did not try this case, did you, Mr. McCoy?
I did not, Your Honor.
Okay, so you're in the same position we are, stuck in the cold record.
So.
Okay.
So I have read the record extensively and tried to consult with counsel to make sure I was talking about the same case that they believe that they tried. At the outset, I want to address the question with respect to the contributory negligence instruction. Plaintiff asked for a directed verdict altogether on contributory negligence on the ground that it should not have been legally submitted. So what we have done and what was advanced in a motion for new trial and here is we haven't expanded the objection. It's a little smaller. Instead of saying that nothing is submissible, we're saying three items were submissible. But certainly the contention was made that contributory negligence should not have been submitted at all.
Okay.
And with respect to that, I understand, and we share some of the concerns that Judge Richmond has expressed about assumption of risk, but let me kind of turn immediately to what Mr. Goldman said about a choice of alternatives. If under Jenkins, you say that an employee has a choice as to how they're going to perform their job, and contributory negligence is premised on the employee's choice between alternatives, the case law says that in order to make a submissible case on contributory negligence, that the railroad has to show that the alternative that was chosen by the employee was unreasonable.
Wouldn't that be a jury question?
Well, I think on the undisputed facts here, Judge, that it would not be, because here are the undisputed facts. And I kind of want to go through them a little bit. The plaintiff chose to use the equipment, the Moffitt forklift and the rigid bucket, because he had used that equipment before for the same task of removing snow outside between the rails with the specific approval of his foreman at that time, Danny Stefka. His current foreman, Mr. Doremus, agreed that Mr. Stefka had the authority to authorize the use of that equipment. And plaintiff and Mr. Haluska, who used that with him, used it to pick up snow that had been pushed into piles, and they had no problems. The bucket, there was another supervisor who testified that he was aware of that happening in 2008. Management certainly knew that that was going on. It was approved by a foreman. During that day, when there was a heavy snowstorm, they only had four pieces of equipment that was available that they could use. There were two Kubotas that had spring-loaded blades.
Is that a four-wheel ATV kind of?
It's a four-wheel tractor. A little four-wheel tractor, and you attach the blade on the front. It could only push snow. The Moffitts and the forklifts were the only equipment that they had available that could pick up and remove snow. And because of the volume of the snow that was falling that day, pushing with the blades was not going to be sufficient to do the job. Mr. Doremus, the foreman, agreed that they had to be able to pick up the snow and remove it. And the Moffitts with rigid buckets were the only equipment that were available to do that. Those were already out with two other carmen by the time plaintiff and Mr. White were ready to go out. They needed to have, one of the features of using the bucket was they had to have a rope to operate the dump mechanism on the bucket on the forklift. The rope was wide. And so they went to Mr. Doremus, Mr. White and plaintiff, and they said, we need a rope. And the testimony was, we need the rope to operate the dump mechanism on the buckets. They had their outside clothes on, their orange overalls. Mr. Doremus told them that where to find the rope. He didn't tell them not to use rigid equipment, even though he had been instructed at a conference call with his superior at 7 o'clock in the morning that no one was to use rigid equipment. Then tell the plaintiff not to use rigid equipment, and Mr. Doremus has agreed that he cannot refute that testimony. So that when you look at all these points, you look at the undisputed evidence, it's our contention, Your Honors, that it could not be said by a reasonable jury that the choice of equipment, that is, the choice to use the Moffitt and the bucket, equipment that had been used before for the same specific task with the approval of management, and no indication from management that day that there was anything the matter with it, on those three points, first three points of instruction 18, he chose to use the Moffitt forklift, chose to use the Moffitt with a rigid bucket, chose to use the Moffitt with the bucket. On those three items.
The third item is the windshield.
Windshield.
Didn't he make a choice to use the forklift with the windshield, whereas Mr. White used one without?
Those were the only two available, Your Honor. So, yeah, he did choose to use the one with the windshield, there's no doubt. But it's our contention also, Your Honor, that any one of those three was a bad instruction, legally insufficient, and you have a general verdict, as you did here.
Why wasn't there a request for a special verdict then, special findings?
There was none, and I can't tell Your Honor why there wasn't a request.
Was it prejudicial in the absence of a request for special verdict?
Well, if you look at the Enright case, which we have cited, and Enright, there were two theories of submitted liability. One was found to be bad, one was found to be okay, and
those
are
legal theories.
Trial.
Counsel, in Enright, you're talking about legal theories, and here we're talking about factual theories. Isn't that the distinction between that case?
Well, Your Honor, I
the cases that say there's different factual theories that might support a jury's finding of negligence or, I suppose, contributory negligence, if any of them. Why there's not a special verdict? We're stuck with that, aren't we?
Well, Your Honor,
you're stuck with it.
The premise, okay, and I take your premise that these are factual theories only, but if you look at the instruction, each one of those three alternatives said he negligently chose to use the forklift. He negligently chose to use the forklift with the cab. He negligently chose to use the forklift with the bucket. And so when it's phrased that way, each of those alternatives tells the jury that they are entitled to find contributory negligence on any one or any of those alone. And so it's our submission, Your Honor, that these are three standalone legal claims of contributory negligence. And if you're talking about a distinction between factual sufficiency and legal sufficiency, they would be factually insufficient, Your Honor, we submit, if there was no evidence that he had actually made the choice to use this equipment. Then the jury could sort that out. Okay, but the jury doesn't know. If you're looking at the distinction Judge Scalia makes in the Griffin case that's carried on by Colorado and Dunaway, and in some of Judge Webb's later opinions, if you look at the distinction between legal sufficiency and factual sufficiency is if the evidence failed to show that he chose to use this equipment. The jury doesn't have a way of knowing the issue of legal sufficiency as to whether or not these items are sufficient as a matter of law to find contributory negligence. And so I argue against the premise that these are necessarily just factual theories and that it makes no difference.
Let's assume just for the purpose that, you know, one or more of us don't buy that theory, your theory. Is it your position that though it would not require reversal on appeal, the trial court had broader discretion to grant a new trial on that basis anyway?
Well, Your Honor, as we presented it, our primary contention to the trial court is that we were entitled to a directed verdict on each of these three items under a directed verdict standard. Okay, and I think it's clear that if that is the case, a new trial would be justified because it would be an error in law.
Let me suggest, counsel, that we might not buy that theory. And let me suggest that if we didn't buy that theory, and the absence of a special verdict might say, oh, we deferred the original judgment on appeal, is it your position that a trial court had broader discretion to grant a new trial than we might have to reverse the original judgment in the case?
Okay. To the extent that that's suggested in McLaughlin, as the court has stated before, we would certainly endorse that. We're aware of the change in the rules that counsel has referred to, and that's why we have placed a primary emphasis on whether or not there's a directed verdict. But obviously, in ruling on a new trial, a court does have discretion. A court does need to do substantial justice. And we would also submit that that would be an alternative method for the court to approach. We've really tried, because we really believe in it, to advance this directed verdict standard. And I hear the court saying that we not be making the same. But we're making an argument here nevertheless.
No, and I'm not saying one way or the other. All okay. I'm saying is, in the event we were to disagree with you,
okay,
would it be your position that a trial court had broader discretion to grant a new trial than, say, we would have to reverse?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I just want to touch briefly on something that was said with respect to the clarifying instruction. The reason that it didn't come up in this form in the second trial was that Judge Stern, in the second trial, decided that he was not going to give an eggshell instruction. He refused the eggshell instruction, and so the situation that arose in the first trial, where both the eggshell instruction and an aggravation instruction were given, and McLaughlin would dictate that you needed to give a clarifying instruction, didn't arise.
Did you object? Did plaintiff file make any kind of objection at that jury instruction conference to the lack of a clarifying instruction, or did they stand idly by while Mr. Goldman argued about it with the judge?
I have reviewed the instruction conference. There is not a specific objection. Certainly, the issue of a clarifying instruction, as required by McLaughlin, was on the table. It was under discussion. And the discussion, as Your Honor has observed, was cut off. And so is there a specific statement from plaintiff saying we need a clarifying instruction other than having the railroad talking about it, having it on the table and it being a topic of discussion? No, Your Honor, there wasn't.
So under Rule 51, how can you grant a new trial if no objection was made?
Okay. Well, and our position, Your Honor, has been that because it was on the table before the court, and the court has the obligation to give correct instructions, that it should be considered. But we recognize the difficulty with the preservation issue, and it's the reason why we made the alternative plain error argument. And we believe, certainly, we think that it has been properly preserved, because the purposes of the preservation rule were preserved. The issue was in front of the court. It was discussed. The court had the opportunity to correct it and deal with it ahead of time. But this is a situation where the absence of a clarifying instruction would have clearly affected the result of the trial. Because the clarifying instruction, if you look at the case law that McLaughlin relies on, the essence of it would be that the railroad is not responsible for pain and disability that existed prior or at the time of this injury, but the railroad is responsible for pain and disability that arises after the injury that has a causal relationship in whole or in part to the injury. The absence of that instruction was prejudicial when you look at the argument that was made by the railroad in terms of how do you apportion this? You apportion it based on 90% of the L5S1 disc was degenerated before the injury. That doesn't relate to pain and disability. You count the number of surgeries he had. He had 5 or 6 surgeries prior to this. And so that, obviously, if you look at the medical evidence, you know, where he had no prior injury to the same levels of the cervical spine here prior, these were new injuries. His prior injuries were perfectly healed. There was nothing the matter with him. no prior injury to the SI. If you look at this and you look at the 75% allocation of apportionment, it's clear that the result here was affected. The need for this kind of instruction is clear in McLaughlin. McLaughlin was in the court file. It was before the court. I'd like to mention one other thing with respect to whether or not the apportionment instruction was submissible. And I've just noted that there were no prior injuries at all to the levels of the cervical spine that were injured here or to the sacroiliac. Our other submission that we've included in our brief is also we believe that the aggravation instruction should not be submissible when, as here, as Dr. Weingarten, the railroad's IME expert, testified, his condition at the L5-S1 disc had stabilized. He was relatively asymptomatic, and he was stabilized at a non-disabling condition. There's language in McLaughlin that supports, I believe, a reading that there should not be reduction for apportionment in those circumstances.
Counsel, you actually have a little more time. Remember, we give you 2 more minutes, so don't rush if you want to say something else.
Sorry.
You do have another minute and a half, roughly, if you want.
Okay, well, and I did feel some pressure to do that.
I could tell.
So to expand that, the premise of McLaughlin, I think, if you look at it, is that what's important is pain and disability, okay? Pain and disability as it existed at the time of the injury and pain and disability after the injury occurred. And so McLaughlin says you don't have a basis for aggravation of pre-existing injury if you haven't injured the same part of the body that was injured before. And here, there's no prior injury to the sacroiliac joint, absolutely new injury. The levels of the cervical spine that were injured had not been injured before.
Hadn't there been surgery previously to the sacroiliac joint? No.
Not to the joints that were affected. He had a fusion at C5, C6. CT scan confirmed that that was pristine. He had an artificial disc at C6, 7. That disc was still good. There was diagnostic testing done by Dr. Kleiner and his associates that showed that the injured discs were C2 up to C5, the disc levels above. But there was no re-injury to the disc level where he had the prior fusion. There was no re-injury to where he had the artificial disc. That was verified because they did diagnostic injections with numbing solution to determine whether or not they should try nerve ablation theory.
And did what Dr. Weingarten testify to the contrary?
He did not. He was completely consistent with that with respect to the cervical spines. Dr. Weingarten's testimony as it related to the lower disc, L5-S1, was that the plaintiff was relatively asymptomatic. That is, since the time that he'd had his last disc surgery in 2001, he'd been continuously working at his job. He had some intermittent chiropractic treatment, not frequent. And then between when he was released from his cervical work in 2009, up to the time of the injury, that he had no reported visits to the doctor, no treatment with any complaints.
Counsel, I think your time is expired.
Okay. Thank you so much, Sean.
Well, I appreciate your arguments. Bailiff, please put 3 minutes on for rebuttal. Thank you. That'll work.
Thank you, and thank you for the extra time. Let me briefly comment on the factual state of the record. First of all, on the last contention, the only level of Mr. Munn's spine that was operated on surgically after the December 31st of 2010 incident was the L5-S1 level of his lumbar spine. He had had two previous surgeries in 2000 and 2001 on that exact same level of his spine. So even if we are to accept plaintiff's contention that you can differentiate on the millimeter or centimeter basis between levels of the spine, the jury was not asked to apportion or render separate verdicts on the cervical versus the lumbar spine, and it's not disputed that he had prior symptoms and two prior surgeries on the L5-S1 level. of his lumbar spine. Let me turn to Your Honor's question concerning the degree of discretion that a trial court has to grant a new trial. Under Cope versus District Court, it's a Colorado Supreme Court decision in 1997. The holding of that case is, if the trial judge's stated reasons for ordering a new trial are not among those enumerated within the rule, then the order for a new trial constitutes an abuse of discretion, and the order should be reversed. In Koch, it dealt with a family law dispute where the district court was facing a situation where it issued final orders, and it found that neither the complainant nor the other side was satisfied with the state of the record.
Production of an instruction that's unsupported by the evidence an error in law?
It is not, as long as the defense itself is properly before the jury.
Do you have any authority on that?
Yes. People versus Dunaway, People versus Douglas, and Griffin versus United States. And Griffin versus United States is the case I want to turn to now. In that case, the United States Supreme Court addressed the issue of, is this insufficiency of the evidence, is that legal error such that we can find that as a matter of law, the verdict needs to be disturbed? And Justice Scalia specifically addresses the contention plaintiff is making now. And Justice Scalia differentiates between error in the insufficiency of the evidence such that a judge might say the evidence is insufficient as a matter of law. That's a factual theory, and that's a factual matter.
This was not, his determination was not that the evidence was insufficient as a matter of law to support a finding of contributory negligence. His finding was that the error, the first three parts of the instruction were erroneous. And if that was, you know, would qualify as legal error, why could not the court, in its discretion, order a new trial?
Because there still has not been a showing of an error in law, when the only legal question for the court to pass on is the defense of contributory negligence properly before the jury?
An incorrect instruction is not an error of law?
Not in the context of a theory of the case instruction when the defense itself is otherwise supported. I see my time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted, and opinion will issue in due course. They were excellent arguments, and I thank you both very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.